Portland Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO.
Valley, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert.
A sweet harmony will set us free and leave our...
Artichoke Music, Satori Men's Chorus, and Mark Bosnian will present Songs of Community, a benefit for KBOO Community Radio, Thursday, November 13th, 7:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. This concert celebrates Portland's love for local music and local community radio. Tickets are available in advance from Brown Paper Tickets or at the door. All proceeds benefit KBOO. To learn more, go to the KBOO website and click under Community Events on the right side of the homepage. That's KBOO.FM. Songs of Community, a benefit for KBOO Community Radio.
And this is KBOO, KBOO Portland. Good morning. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, it's Political Perspectives. Host Jay Thiemeyer today speaks with Mike Carnosh of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, Jim Robison, chair of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, and Barbara Quinn of Willamette Speaks about the state of the Willamette River and what it will take to restore the river. At 9:30, Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock interviews Professor David Collings about his book, Our Stolen Future, Stolen Future and Broken Present. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we got Flashpoints featuring today an interview with Palestinian-American professor Stephen Salaita, who was unhired by the University of Illinois after he spoke out against the latest Israeli slaughter in Gaza. We also hear about Palestinian-American community leader Razmea Ouade, who was convicted of an immigration violation in Detroit this week. And at 11 o'clock, we got the Dirt Bag. Today, host Glenn Andreessen and his guest Jim Gilbert offer tips on cold proofing your tender fruits and veggies and making suggestions on how to get your garden beds ready now for spring planting. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for your community radio station. If you're not a current member, you can become one very easily by going to kboo.fm and click where it says donate today. Thanks for doing that. All right, we're going to get right to Political Perspectives today, hosted by Jay Thiemeyer.
This is Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO, volunteer-driven community radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm talking with Mike Carnosh from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, and with Jim Robison, who has been chair for the past several years of the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, as well as with Barbara Quinn, who is also on the Community Advisory Group for the Harbor. And our concern today is Willamette Speaks. Status of the Willamette River today, what needs to be done to restore the river and to respond to the Superfund category, how to get the polluters to pay up for cleaning up the river and how to do that. So, Barbara, what exactly is Willamette Speaks?
Willamette Speaks is a series of gathering stories that is sponsored by the Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group and Metro, and it's a series of events to engage the community in storytelling about the river. And at these events, we're going to have tabling by the Portland Harbor Community Advisory members who are going to talk to people about what's going on with the Superfund. So we have an upcoming event, the Willamette Speaks Storytelling, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, November 16th, Sunday, at the Linton Community Center at 10614 Northwest St. Helens Road from 4 to 6 p.m. So it's absolutely free. Everyone's welcome. There will be light refreshments served. And you can see more on Willamette Speaks on Facebook.
Thank you. I want to start with you, Mike. What is the Willamette River?
Well, thanks, Jay. I want to start, first of all, by saying I really appreciate you having me on here, and I appreciate Jim's and Barbara's work on the CAG as well. I think it's really important to get people out there and engaged and connected to the river, because for thousands and thousands of years, this river has been everything. It's been life for thousands and thousands of people, and it's really a living being. It's like a big organism. It moves around, or it's supposed to move around. It has different ways of being at different times. It provides people with the things that they need to survive. Water, it provides people with a means to get around. It provides people with food that's very important to survival. And above all of that, too, it's a place to be connected with all things. And it's a really rich, biodiverse environment. So that's what the river is and what it means. And that's why I'm so happy that folks like Barbara and Jim are so engaged in this.
Anyone who is familiar with the Willamette River today knows that the industrial pollution has certainly reduced its viability. But if we think of the river as not something separate from us, but part of us, that we're part of it, this is our environment, you can't draw a line or a disconnect between the river and the people around it who are responsible for it. In other words, responsible for recognizing the heritage and for doing what's necessary to respond to the Superfund designation. Jim, could you tell us about the history of the Superfund designation and what's going on with that now?
It's important to remember the river has a history in the last 150, 200 years of being polluted. And there was a major effort made in the 1920s to recognize that it was polluted. There was a community uprise to really try to clean up the river because it had gotten so bad that the state actually told people, do not swim in the river. If you swim in the river, you will get sick. And at the time, the threat was you would immediately get sick and you would be dying fairly quickly because it was so bad. An effort was made to clean up that part of the pollution. But there were really two parts to pollution. There's what I refer to as kind of the more organic components, which were things like what comes out of the sewers and gets dumped into the river. That has been largely cleaned up now. There's still some, occasionally there's some overflows that go into the river, but the major part of that pollution has been cleaned up. So the river is much cleaner now than it was in the 20s. But the other part is the chemical pollution. And that is what is produced by a lot of the industry in the area that over the last 100 years or so has put a lot of these chemicals into the river that don't break down. And the problem with these chemicals is that they can cause major problems for organisms in the river, for the fish, for the animals that live along the river. They can be endocrine disruptors, which disrupt the reproduction of organisms. They can be cancer-causing. They can be causing other types of deformities in the life along the river. These chemicals don't break down over time. They don't break down as quickly as the more organic components would.
How long has the Superfund designation been in place, and what prompted it?
The year 2000 is when this stretch of the river was declared a Superfund site by the EPA. It's essentially from approximately the mouth of the Willamette to where it confluence with the Columbia River, but more directly about a mile up from the Columbia River. And then from there up to approximately the Steel Bridge or the Broadway Bridge or the Fremont Bridge right in that area. It's not an exact definition because the area, as they're doing the cleanup, they can extend that cleanup a little bit beyond the boundaries. They do the study area focuses on this essentially a 12-mile stretch of the river, but most of the cleanup will be in specific sites along the river, and that could overlap a little bit with the edges of how the definition is done.
When you say the study, what specifically are you talking about?
There was a group of local industry as well as some of the local government agencies, such as the City of Portland and the Port of Portland, who signed an agreement with the EPA to conduct the studies of the river. And this is what they call nature and extent, where they determine what is the nature of the pollution in the river and what is the extent of it. That's been going on for the last 14 years now.
Do you see that as a stall?
No. Well, that group is called the Lower Willamette Group in terms of doing that study. That study has been largely done, and they're producing the document called the feasibility study. And the feasibility study is what lays out ideas and plans for how it can be cleaned up. And that process is being dragged out a bit right now because there are issues that Lower Willamette Group develops their feasibility study of how they think it can be done. EPA says, well, we want to see this document a bit different. We want to see things laid out a bit different. When you're dealing with some of the industry involved here, I see two different pressures occurring. One pressure is to try to just get things done as fast as you can and whitewash it and be able to say, okay, let's just declare it clean and move on. That's on the one hand, that's one set of interests that will try to say, we don't really need to clean this up much more. And then another set of interests that will say, let's delay this and not deal with this until it's way out in the future and we can deal with it then. We can kind of let things wash away before then.
Yeah, let me interrupt because we've done 10 minutes and we're going to have to speed it up and I'm going to have to ask specific questions. Let me go from there. I wanted to hear more, Mike, from as far as the Native heritage perspective, can you tell us a spiritual identity of the river and the spiritual identity for people who appreciate the river?
The river is home to a number of people. Speaking for my employer, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, it's their home that they've been in since time immemorial. They signed a treaty, the Willamette Valley Treaty in 1855, that ceded the title to the United States, but not the responsibility for taking care of that river. And that's something that the people of the tribe have felt that responsibility all the way through history. And as home, it is just that, a responsibility. It's a thing, a living thing, to be cared for. That's what as simply as I can put it, and as briefly, having a home, having the privilege, and enjoying this rich, wonderful place that is Portland, having that comes with a responsibility to take care of it as well, and that's. That's part of all the old stories. A lot of the old stories have that responsibility built into it. And that's something that children are taught at a pretty young age.
What is the responsibility of the Confederated Tribes in the Community Advisory Group?
Well, what I see us as a partner of the Community Advisory Group. Try as much as possible to stay connected with the CAG and to make sure that they get news in a timely manner from the Trustee Council. And the Trustee Council is a group of eight governments, including the Grand Ronde Tribe, that deal with the restoration end of the Superfund site.
What specifically are the tribes prioritizing in their recommendation to the advisory?
As far as restoration, I think it's safe to say the tribes place high priority on the salmon species of the area, Pacific lamprey, sturgeon, and native plants. Those four things are high priority. That's not to say that a lot of other resources, including but not limited to the water itself, are not very, very important, because they are. But those things that I listed off are probably the highest on the tribe's priority.
There are different aspects of restoring the river and disposing of the waste. Jim, could you please distinguish between those two things and what you would like to see as far as the cleanup, the disposal? What's the ideal situation, and what does the EPA push you for?
Let me just start with just kind of a general comment that a lot of engineers will say you can do things fast, cheap, or right. Pick two. So you can pick two of those. And we really focus on, we want to be sure that it's done right. So the costs are a concern, the timeliness is a concern, but we want to be certain that it's done right. And I don't want to see shortcuts taken to get past requirements in order to just ensure that it could be written off as being done. One of the things that we would like to see is as much of the contaminant that's in there as can be to be actually removed from the river. And once it's removed from the river, then you can choose what you're going to do with it. But that's the first question, is removal from the river. We would love to see in-site treatment. And there are some experiments that have been done around the country, various sites where they've been able to do some in-site treatments to actually break down the chemicals and change them so they're no longer toxic. There is potential there, but these are methods that haven't been proven to work in a situation like what we have in the Willamette River. So it'd be great to have some pilot projects to really be able to test those and see how well those can work in this situation. If it can be proven to work, for example, if you take a section of the Swan Island Lagoon and do a test pilot project there and develop a method that works to clean up the contaminants without having to dredge everything out, then you could expand that to the rest of the area. There are processes that will actually break down the chemicals. There's a company that we had presentations from at the CAG that they've done this process elsewhere in the country. The only thing they've not been able to do is develop a process to actually implement it on the river bottom. The way they've been able to do it now is dredge material out, treat the material, and get the chemicals broken down and then have clean material.
Why is it cheaper to dredge it out? It sounds like that would be more expensive to dredge it out and have to move it and dispose of it somewhere else.
The complication is that their process uses the bacteria that's in the sediment to trigger it to actually eat the chemicals. And it doesn't create some kind of super bacteria. It just triggers a bacteria that's already there to then eat the chemicals in the soil to recognize it as food for them. That process requires oxygen, and the bottom of the river is anaerobic. There's no oxygen reaching the sediment in the bottom of the river in the quantity that's necessary for the process to work. That's why they have to remove the sediment in order to do the treatment. One thing that was interesting was we had a presentation from them on this process, then we had a presentation at the same meeting immediately afterwards talking about using activated charcoal as a biochar, as a additive in this process. And it's actually something that, because of the nature of how it captures oxygen and brings material together, it could actually be used as a method to deliver this process that was developed to the bottom of the river. So there's been some discussion going on about that, for how they could combine these two technologies, these two methods, in order to do treatment on the river bottom. And that's where there would have to be more testing and pilot projects to see how well that would work.
How agreeable is the EPA to that approach?
Well, the EPA is open to looking at all these processes and all these possibilities. But like many people, they've been stung in the past. So there have been times when they've tried out a new process and it didn't work. Then they had to go in and re-clean the same site because the experimental process didn't work. That's why they want to see proven track records.
The EPA, of course, is affected by funding cuts, sequestration, and so on. And I was reading today about how Senator Inhofe, the oil industry's friend from Oklahoma, is going to be chair of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. He is like the ultimate human-caused climate change denier. So we can expect from him, as the head of this committee, obstruction. It was mentioned starting investigations into the appropriateness of certain things that the EPA is doing. What do you expect from the EPA under Inhofe?
Well, fortunately, the EPA won't be directly under Inhofe. They're under Obama, and his appointee is the director of the EPA. So the EPA will still be able to act on what they're doing now. It's a matter of time for what will change because of changing priorities as the budgets are adopted by Congress, and of course changes in how much authority our senators can have, because right now we have Earl Blumenauer has been pushing to make sure that there is Pentagon funding to help with the cleanup. That might not happen with Republican majorities controlling the budgets. Wyden and Merkley both are able to right now keep an eye on the process that's happening here and would be open to hearing from constituents on what they can do to help make this move forward properly. But now Wyden and Merkley will be in the minority in the Senate, so they won't have as much ability to influence things as they could have before. One thing that's important to note here is that because of the way the Superfund law is established, it's the responsible parties that need to pay for the cleanup of the river. So we don't necessarily need to worry about what federal funding there will be, other than to what extent the federal government is a responsible party, because the Pentagon is a responsible party on this side as well. But the local governments, the city and Port of Portland, both have some responsibility here as well. And then the local industry have responsibility, and so they will need to be paying for this. A lot of the pressure that local elected officials feel now is from local industry saying, we want to get this done without spending too much money, and we want it done quickly, and we want to be able to say that it's done so that we can move forward with other investments. The local governments that impact this need to hear from their constituents that we want this cleanup done right. We don't just want it done as quickly as possible. We don't just want it done as cheaply as possible. We want it done right so that future generations don't have to deal with remaining legacy pollutants.
The Confederated Tribes, are they organizing to impact this process? Are they getting involved in the political process of like exactly what Jim has just been talking about?
To an extent, yeah, Jay. The tribes are active in that way, and I was really fortunate to, when EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy was in town a few months back, I was really, really fortunate to be able to talk to her for a few minutes and just let her know how special this place is for the tribes and for everybody. You know, the government types talk to other government types all the time, but one thing I wanted to put out there was in Portland, the local voices really do matter. If people think that the process is not including local voices or not including them enough, then I think if there's more of the local people and they talk just a little bit louder, people do listen. Gina McCarthy was really, really interested in that local voice.
You're one person. Were there other people from the Confederated Tribes?
It wasn't an organized kind of thing. It was actually a very quick kind of ad hoc site visit. I don't think it was originally on her itinerary, but you know, it is something that there are five tribes on the trustee council, and those five tribal representatives are pretty well organized, especially on the restoration side. Now, on the cleanup side, sometimes it's the case and sometimes it's not, but we have been able to come out with unified tribal positions on certain things like the confined disposal facility issue, or a CDF. That is one thing that the tribes have gotten organized on.
People aren't going to be real familiar with the question of disposal and how to do that in the CDF, which is, Jim, could you tell us what that is?
Well, CDF is the proposal that's out there right now. Is in Terminal 4, Slip 1, there is a slip that is... What a slip is, for people who don't know, it's a little area cut out of the side of the river where there's water so that ships could move into that slip to load and unload. But the proposal is that this one slip would be bermed off at the river end so that it creates a berm parallel with the river bank adjacent to there. And then you have an area behind the boom behind the berm that can be filled in with material dredged out of the river. The upside of that is that it's much cheaper than moving material to somewhere else that would be a more secure location. The downside is that it leaves it there right next to the river, where it could then potentially leach back out into the river, or if the berm was to fail at some point, material would go back out into the river and you'd have to deal with it again. Another failure of a CDF is that right now we have very limited habitat for the fish in the river, and I've been looking at numbers on sturgeon. Sturgeon population has been going down. We know from reports of fishermen in the area that sturgeon are using that slip quite a bit, especially during the winter months. Removing it is simply removing another habitat that sturgeon use and that other fish use. I would rather improve it, make it better habitat.
I appreciate what you've told us. There are a lot of details, and absorbing it all, of course, takes a lot of time. I appreciate Mike and Jim and Barbara taking the time to contribute what you have been able to. And I urge people to follow this. A good way to do that is Willamette Speaks. Barbara, could you tell us how to contact Willamette Speaks and what's going on
absolutely.
This Sunday?
At this Willamette Speaks storytelling event, there will be a table with CAG members present. And if you would like ways to get in touch with the EPA, ways to weigh in on the process, if you want to learn more about the process, come to this event and you will find ways to do that. And the event, once again, it's sponsored by Portland Harbor Community Advisory Group, Metro, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, and KBOO. And it's November 16th, Sunday, upcoming Sunday, at the Linton Community Center. There will be a sign out front that you should be able to see from the road to identify the location.
And it's that's on Route 30?
It's on St. Helens Road, which is also Highway 30. Yeah.
Can I mention our website? The Portland Harbor CAG website is portlandharborcag.info. portlandharborcag.info.
And that's a great source of information, too. So the event's from 4 to 6 p.m. It's absolutely free. There will be light refreshments, and we have a lineup of really interesting speakers. One is going to be Michael Carnosh from the Grand Ronde Tribe, and then we're going to have Linton residents as well as others. So it would be great if people can come out and experience that.
Thank you very much. This has been Jay Thiemeyer for KBOO Community Radio, talking with Jim Robeson from the Portland Harbor CAG, the advisory group for the harbor, and Mike Carnosh from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, and Barbara Quinn, who is also with the advisory group. Thank you very much.
It's 9:28. You're tuned to KBOO, KBOO Community Radio. Coming right up next, it's a segment from Radio EcoShock today, featuring an interview with Professor David Collings about his book Stolen Future and Broken Present. Stay tuned at 10 for Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia at 10:15 Flashpoints. And okay, Let's listen to one little announcement, and then we'll get right to Radio EcoShock.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirt Bag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirt Bag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
K-B-O-O Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
What is climate change? It's not an event. It's a complete change of context in which events take place. And no wonder we have trouble grasping it. And I'm reminded of that viral video, once again, where a man filming a triple rainbow breaks down in tearful wonder, and he says over and over again, "What does it mean?" And on Radio EcoShock, we go into depth with scientists who explain the functioning of the atmosphere, the soil, and the sea, and the creatures who live there. Today, we're going into the humanities to ask scholar David A. Collings, what does it mean? Collings has written about romanticism, poetry, and monstrous society. He's a professor of English at Bowdoin College in Maine. Now he's turned to the largest story of this or any other generation, human disruption of the climate. His new book is titled Stolen Future, Broken Present, The Human Significance of Climate Change. David Collings, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
It's been a long journey from the British Romantics to, you know, a couple of centuries ago to the hard science of climate change. What stimulated you to make this leap?
I was a little frustrated by the fact that all of us are going through so much just as human beings. And it was hard for me to find anyone discussing that fact. I read widely in the science and the policy, the economics, the technologies surrounding climate change, and just felt so many emotions and so many thoughts that eventually I thought, okay, if no one else is writing about it, I should do it myself. So it's definitely a departure for me, but it was transformative finally to get those thoughts from my own mind out into the world and share them with other people. Very therapeutic, very positive to enter conversations like this one with